Galatians 4, beginning with verse 4. But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law so that they might receive adoption as sons. And because you are sons, God has sent the Spirit of His Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son. And if a son, then an heir through God. Just two technical notes there. Verse 4, the main verb is sent forth. God sent forth. That is followed by two purpose statements that modify that. God the Father sent forth the Son, born under a woman, born of woman, born under the law, for two purposes. Verse 5, roughly, that He might redeem those who were under the law, and that we might receive adoption as sons. So roughly, the idea of the purposes of why God the Father sent forth the Son, the purposes are twofold. Redemption and adoption. They're parallel in the thought here of Paul. All right, well, we're doing a series of walking with giants kind of thing, Christian biographies. And this evening, we're going to be considering John Lafayette Jadot. And he served the Presbyterian Church as pastor to slaves for 27 years. And a theologian at Columbia Seminary, when it was really in Columbia, South Carolina, for 18 years. He was famous for his preaching, and he was Benjamin Morgan Palmer's choice to succeed the great James Henley Thornwell at the theology chair at Columbia. Benjamin Morgan Palmer, you may know, was the pastor of First Presbyterian Church in New Orleans for 50 years when they would still have the outbreaks of plague there. And people fled New Orleans. It was, if you could, you got out of town. It was basically a ghost town. It was empty. And Palmer would stay. He would stay in the midst of plague. And he would visit the sick and the dying. And the testimony from a Jewish rabbi in town at the time said that Palmer won the heart of New Orleans during times of plague. Everyone fled but himself and those who were unable to go. So Benjamin Morgan Palmer, a man of some stature in the historic Presbyterian Church, and he wanted Jadot to become the theology chair at Columbia. Jadot was a leading churchman and theologian of the Southern Presbyterian Church after the War for Southern Independence. So if you're following or taking notes, whatever, I've 3 points, of course, always. There's no other number you can have. But just to try to have some kind of a historic landmark to build his life around and for it to be easy for us to follow, I've got his life before the war, okay? His life during the war, be very brief there, and then his life after the war, okay? So, before the war for Southern independence, and two things under this, his childhood and his church. He was born in November of 1825 on James Island, which is just across the Ashley River from Charleston. And his parents were French, of French Huguenot descendants, and they were solid Presbyterians of the Scottish type. That word Huguenot is new to you. They were the French Calvinists that stayed in France when the Edict of Nantes was canceled, and if you were Protestant, you were put to death. And the Huguenots stayed. And their pastors stayed, and they were slaughtered. So, rich heritage, French Huguenots. That's the heritage of Jadot. His cousin James Colcock Jones. I don't think I've ever met anyone with a middle name Colcock. His cousin grew just a couple of plantations away from him. And in our day, y'all, he is known as the father of slave missions. It's been very interesting. Last couple of years, there's some kind of resurgence of writing about missionary endeavors in the South, the southern states. And at least the works that I've seen, two people are always mentioned. Charles Colcock Jones and John Lafayette Jardot, both of them. So you can well imagine on a cotton plantation in southeastern United States, he was raised, it was fairly remote, cotton plantation, but there was a church not too far away where the Bible was taught. And the doctrines of God's sovereign grace were preached. Now, importantly, and for our purposes, I want you to be sure and get this. Importantly, his childhood playmates were young African-American children living on his and the surrounding cotton plantations. You know, they're in the neighborhood. You want somebody to play with, there they are. And that was his circumstance. He grew up with these children as his playmates, living in relatively close quarters with such a large plantation of enslaved Africans. Jardot became proficient with the Gullah language. Now, some of you may have been to a Gullah festival in Savannah or Charleston. They're still having them. But it was spoken by the Sea Island African Americans, and he became proficient even with the rhythm and the words you would emphasize, how you would structure a sentence, and so forth. All right, that's his childhood before the war. Now, what about the church before the war? Well, in the early 1850s, Second Presbyterian Church in Charleston started a new mission work. They had African Americans that were members, and they were growing in such number, they thought, we need to plant another church in town. And so they did. It was the Anson Street Mission. And they had a member on their staff, John Edgar, who had been a missionary for a number of years and had come back home, and he pastored them in the basement of Second Presbyterian Church. There in Charleston. But he wanted to kind of hand off the work. He wanted to do other things. And so he and Jardot were friends. He said, I think you would be ideal. We have 36 members. Would you come pastor this mission church? It's entirely made up of slaves, but would you be the pastor? Well, in 1854, Jardot said yes, and he was the pastor of 36 members. It was no time, y'all, before that church had 600 members under Jardot's preaching. And they had a regular attendance of 1,500 1,500, the membership plus visitors. Well, word got around. The church was growing rapidly under Jardot's preaching, and a much larger building was needed. And sure enough, the citizens of Charleston pitched in, and they built, at the time, that was the largest church building in Charleston. And Doug Kelly says, likely in the entire state of South Carolina. It would house about 1,500, and they had a kind of a wraparound balcony. And the black members got the front row seats. You know, they got the bottom floor there right in front of the pulpit. And if you were a visitor or a white, you were up there. I read one account of an eyewitness said the building, the room was so large that if you were on this balcony, you could barely make out the faces of your friends on that one. And they're just trying to come up with a building that would house the people that would come to hear Jardot preach. The building cost $25,000. And the citizens of Charleston put up the money themselves. They ended up moving to this, and the membership named the church Zion. Zion. Nickname was Big Zion, the biggest church in town, and it had overflowing crowds every service. Well, that's his life and his childhood and church before the war. Very briefly, during the war for Southern independence, at the beginning of it, he was a chaplain. And at the end of it, he was a POW. And while a prisoner of war, he was ministering to Southern and Northern troops that were wounded and needed to hear the gospel. He preached to both. So that's all I'm going to say about that during the war. So thirdly, after the war, we'll spend most of our time here. After the war, two subpoints, his return and what about Reconstruction in South Carolina? His return, while he was imprisoned by the Yankees, he received letters from Zion Church in Charleston. When are you coming home? We're waiting on you. He, by wagon, was able to find his way. I think the prison camp was in Ohio. Took a wagon. Took him weeks to get down to the South Carolina state line. From there, he took a train to Charleston. And what do you think would be? I mean, everybody's free at this point, right? And the Yankees are in charge, and they're filling Charleston with their rules and telling everybody how to behave. And everything is different. It's an enormous earthquake, social earthquake has taken place. Now you have this large, the largest church in town, predominantly African Americans, former slaves. What do you think, how do you think they'd respond to a white preacher? When Jericho got out of the train, there was a delegation of the... It's so good. There was a delegation of the black elders and the black deacons he had ordained for that church. They carried him on their shoulders through the streets of Charleston. And said, please come back and preach to us like you did before. We don't hear those stories much, do we? Jericho's account was that he was greeted with, quote, super abounding enthusiasm. So that's his return. They took him back to Zion Church. And though there were many social changes, he picked up where he left off, being their pastor, preaching to them with overflowing crowds. What about, you extend that beyond, what about Reconstruction? And this is, I want to highlight two themes or two things for which Jericho is noted. First of all, his writing on the diaconate, writing on deacons. And secondly, his writing on the doctrine of adoption. On the diaconate, first of all, during Reconstruction, the greater part of his life and ministry had been spent among the most destitute of Southern society. And he was acquainted with that firsthand. He implemented diaconal care for the sick and needy of Charleston through the ministry of Zion Church. Jericho made a strong effort to give a worthwhile place and work to the office of deacon. He wrote extensively on it. We still have some of the leading articles. You can get them on any historic Southern website that has church issues. Anyway, I can give that to you. But he wrote extensively on the office of deacon, and he seemed in part to be following something Presbyterians were doing in Scotland at the time, Thomas Chalmers, you may have heard of him and his work among the poor in Glasgow, Scotland. He wrote extensively on it. Jared O. seemed to be picking up on what his brother did in Scotland, and he implemented it there in Charleston after the war. His first article was on the importance of the diaconate. Y'all, he had seen it work. He had seen deacons work and what it was like when they had a clear sense of their calling and they were at work in the congregation there at Zion Church, Big Zion. In 1880, at the General Assembly for the Southern Presbyterian Church, it was actually in Charleston, and the issue, they were debating the office of deacon. And a lot of people thought that the office of deacon should be subsumed into the office of elder, and that there was really just one office in the church. It was elder. Well, Jared O. would have none of that, and for many reasons. And on one occasion during the debate at General Assembly, he argued for 2 hours on the floor of assembly about the importance of deacon. I mean, y'all, we're used to TV with commercials about every 13 minutes, so listening to somebody argue a case for 2 hours, kind of hard to imagine. But one eyewitness said that during that debate, and I quote, said his reasoning was ablaze. His flights of eloquence were sublime. It was logic set on fire. Good night. Have you ever heard anybody speak like that? And what's he talking about? The office of deacon. Who ever heard of such a thing in our day? Well, he fought for the office of deacon because he'd seen it work there at Big Zion Church. I usually don't go snooping around on what the deacons are doing, but over the last couple of weeks, I have stumbled upon two things. Not going to mention any names or situations at all, but both of them have just warmed my heart. And those of you especially that are presently serving, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for your work. I didn't know y'all were doing these two particular things. I didn't know. I don't go snooping around. But when I found out, I just thought, thank the Lord. Thank the Lord. Thank you, brothers. Thank you. During Reconstruction, the diaconate. The second thing on which he wrote and argued was the doctrine of adoption. Interesting. Of the great creeds of Christendom, none of them contain a chapter or a statement about adoption except the Westminster Confession of Faith, chapter 12. It's a little short one, but chapter 12 is devoted to the subject of our adoption as sons and daughters of the living God through the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, from the Westminster Assembly and their development or having formally a chapter, theological heading of adoption there. You know who developed that thought? And it seemed to be across the board. People say, here are the folks that developed the doctrine of adoption. Scottish Presbyterians and Southern Presbyterians. I've got a shelf of writings on the doctrine of adoption in my office. And I think only maybe one or two books are from out of the South or out of Scotland. They're the ones that developed it. Dr. Doug Kelly says that Jared O. and those he influenced wrote and preached with, he says, unusual fullness on the doctrine of adoption. He wrote that every Christian is adopted as an heir of God and a joint heir with Christ to an inheritance which is, quote, all that can be conceived or believed as embraced in the fatherly favor and love of God. We're heirs of that. both now and hereafter, the riches of grace, riches of glory. Jerido has it's wonderful. If you maybe even think about reading some of his work, find his work on adoption. And he says, after this long description of it and the blessings of it, rooting it in Scripture, he says, in a word, the whole that I've said signifies one word, home. We're talking about home. A place where you're safe. A place where you're loved. Home. That's the doctrine of adoption. Now, there were two factors in Jerido's life that seemed to give, at least in modern considerations, to give an impetus to him writing on this subject or expanding it so much. One was his mother died when he was 8 years old. And by his 10th year, he was living in a boarding house in Charleston and was very nearly an orphan. He'd been sent to school. His dad was back on the farm working. And Jerido was just on his own. But the second factor, more importantly, that Jerido was a pastor in Charleston when he began to write on the doctrine of adoption. Now think of his circumstances. He was a pastor to African Americans who were slaves, but who were also sons of the living God. Sons and daughters of the living God. The doctrine of adoption would have been a very effective pastoral encouragement and balm to men and women who were consigned to a servant's station in life. Not only did the doctrine grant slaves the hopeful status of sons and heirs of the promises, but it also served to remind them that even their masters were slaves to one far their superior. The doctrine of adoption was readily embraced by Jerido's audience. Boy, it just makes sense, doesn't it? Given their circumstances. And that was after the war. It's during Reconstruction that he was writing so much on it. Well, in our day, I read a book review here earlier this year where a theological book reviewer said that the doctrine of adoption is enjoying something of a golden age in our day, at least in evangelical and reformed circles. So there's a surge of interest. A number of new books have been written on it. And it's flourishing. The doctrine of adoption is flourishing in our circles. But y'all, our roots go back to Charleston and Big Zion Church. Okay, well, that's Jerido.